At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Chapter 16 of Alice Adams. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Jeannie. Alice Adams by Booth Tarkington. Chapter 16. He meant his own transgression and his own way, for Walter's stubborn refusal appeared to Adams, just then, as one of the inexplicable but righteous besettings he must encounter in following that way. "Oh, Lordy, Lord!" he groaned. And then, as resentment moved him, "That dang boy! Dang idiot!" Yet he knew himself for a greater idiot, because he had not been able to tell Walter the truth. He could not bring himself to do it, nor even to state his case in its best terms, and that was because he felt that even in its best terms the case was a bad one. Of all his regrets, the greatest was that, in a moment of vanity and tenderness, 25 years ago, he had told his young wife a business secret. He had wanted to show how important her husband was becoming, and how much the head of the universe, J. A. Lamb, trusted to his integrity and ability. The great man had an idea. He thought of branching out a little, he told Adams, confidentially, and there were possibilities of profit in glue. What he wanted was a liquid glue to be put into little bottles and sold cheaply. "That kind of thing sells itself," he said. "The kind of thing that pays its own small way as it goes along until it has profits enough to begin advertising it right. Everybody has got to use glue, and if I make mine convenient and cheap, everybody'll buy mine. But it's got to be glue that'll stick. It's got to be the best. And if we find how to make it, we've got to keep it a big secret, of course, or anybody can steal it from us. There was a man here last month. He knew a formula he wanted to sell me, sight unseen. But he was in such a hurry I got suspicious, and I found he'd managed to steal it, working for the big packers and their glue works. We've got to find a better glue than that, anyhow. I'm going to set you and Campbell at it. You're a practical, wide-awake young feller, and Campbell's a mighty good chemist. I guess you two boys ought to make something happen." His guess was shrewd enough. Working in a shed a little way outside the town, where their cheery employer visited them sometimes to study their malodorous stews, the two young men found what Lamb had set them to find. But Campbell was thoughtful over the discovery. "Look here," he said, "why ain't this just about yours and mine? After all, it may be Lamb's money that's paid for the stuff we've used, but it hasn't cost much." "But he pays us," Adams remonstrated, horrified by his companion's idea. "He paid us to do it. It belongs absolutely to him." "Oh, I know he thinks it does," Campbell admitted plaintively. "I suppose we've got to let him take it. It's not patentable, and he'll have to do pretty well by us when he starts his factory, because he's got to depend on us to run the making of the stuff so that the workmen can't get on to the process. You better ask him the same salary I do, and mine's going to be pretty high." But the high salary, thus pleasantly imagined, was never paid. Campbell died of typhoid fever that summer, leaving Adams and his employer the only possessors of the formula, an unwritten one. And Adams, pleased to think himself more important to the great man than ever, told his wife that there could be little doubt of his being put in sole charge of the prospective glue works. Unfortunately, the enterprise remained prospective. Its projector had already become unveiled in another sideline, as he told Adams. One of his sons had persuaded him to take up a cough lozenge to be called the Jalam Balm Trochee, and the lozenge did well enough to amuse Mr. Lamb and occupy his spare time, which was really about all he had asked of the glue project. He had all the money anybody ought to want, he said, when Adams urged him, and he could start up this little glue sideline at any time. The formula was safe in their two heads. At intervals, Adams would seek opportunity to speak of the little glue sideline to his patron, and suggest that the years were passing, but Lamb, petting the other hobbies, had lost interest. "Oh, I'll start it up some day, maybe. If I don't, I may turn it over to my heirs. It's always an asset, worth something or other, of course. We'll probably take it up some day, though, you and I." The sun persistently declined to rise on that day, and as time went on, Adams saw that his rather timid urgings bored his employer, and he ceased to bring up the subject. Lamb apparently forgot all about glue, but Adams discovered that, unfortunately, there was someone else who remembered it. "It's really yours," she argued, that painful day when, for the first time, she suggested his using his knowledge for the benefit of himself and his family. "Mr. Campbell might have had a right to part of it, but he died and didn't leave any kin, so it belongs to you." "Suppose J. A. Lamb hires me to saw some wood," Adams said. "Would the sticks belong to me?" "He hasn't got any right to take your invention and bury it," she protested. "What good is it doing him if he doesn't do anything with it? What good is it doing anybody? None in the world. And what harm would it do him if you went ahead and did this all for yourself and for your children? None in the world. And what could he do to you if he was old pig enough to get angry with you for doing it? He couldn't do a single thing, and you've admitted he couldn't, yourself. So what's your reason for depriving your children and your wife of the benefits you know you could give him?" "Nothing but decency," he answered, and she had her ready reply for that. It seemed to him that, strive as he would, he could not reach her mind with even the plainest language, while everything that she said to him, with such vehemence, sounded like so much obstinate gibberish. Over and over he pressed her with the same illustration on the point of ownership, though he thought he was varying it. "Suppose he hired me to build him a house. Would that be my house?" "He didn't hire you to build him a house. You and Campbell invented—" "Look here. Suppose you give a cook a soup bone and some vegetables and pay her to make you a soup. Does she got the right to take it and sell it? You know better." "I know one thing. If that old man tried to keep your own invention from you, he's no better than a robber." They never found any point of contact in all their passionate discussions of this ethical question, and the question was no more settled between them now that Adams had succumbed than it had ever been. But at least the wrangling about it was over. They were grave together, almost silent, and an uneasiness prevailed with her as much as with him. He had already been out of the house to walk around the small green yard, and on Monday afternoon he sent for a taxicab and went downtown, but kept a long way from the wholesale section, where stood the formidable old oblong pile of Lamb and Company. He arranged for the sale of the bonds he had laid away, and for placing a mortgage upon his house, and on his way home, after 5 o'clock, he went to see an old friend, a man whose term of service with Lamb and Company was even a little longer than his own. This veteran, returned from the day's work, was sitting in front of the apartment house where he lived, but when the cab stopped at the curb he rose and came forward, offering a jocular greeting. "Well, well, Virgil Adams, I always thought you had a sporty streak in you. Travel in your own hired private automobile nowadays, do you? Pamperin' yourself because you're still layin' off sick, I expect." "Oh, I'm well enough again, Charlie Lohr," Adams said, as he got out and shook hands. Then, telling the driver to wait, he took his friend's arm, walked to the bench with him, and sat down. "I've been practically well for some time," he said. "I'm fixin' to get into harness again." "Being sick has certainly produced a change of heart in you," his friend laughed. "You're the last man I ever expected to see blowin' yourself, or anybody else, to a taxicab. For that matter, I never heard of you being in any kind of a cab, lessen it might be when you were pallbearer for somebody. What's come over you?" "Well, I got to turn over a new leaf, and that's a fact," Adams said. "I got a lot to do, and the only way to accomplish it, it's got to be done soon, or I won't have anything to live on while I'm doing it." "What are you talking about? What you got to do except to get strong enough to come back to the old place?" "Well," Adams paused, then coughed, and said slowly, "Fact is, Charlie Lohr, I've been thinking likely I wouldn't come back." "What? What you talking about?" "Nope," Adams said. "I've been thinking I might likely kind of branch out on my own account." "Well, I'll be doggoned." Old Charlie Lohr was amazed. He ruffled up his gray mustache with thumb and forefinger, leaving his mouth open beneath, like a dark cave under a tangled wintry thicket. "Why, that's the doggonest thing I ever heard," he said. "I already am the oldest inhabitant down here, but if you go, there won't be anybody else of the old generation at all. What on earth are you thinking of going into?" "Well," said Adams, "I rather you didn't mention it till I get started. Of course, anybody'll know what it is by then, but I have been kind of planning to put a liquid glue on the market." His friend, still ruffling the gray mustache upward, stared at him in frowning perplexity. "Glue?" he said. "Glue?" "Yeah. I've been sort of milling over the idea of taking up something like that." "Handling it for some firm, you mean?" "Nope, making it. Sort of a glue works, likely." Lohr continued to frown. "Let me think," he said. Didn't the old man have some such idea once himself?" Adams leaned forward, rubbing his knees, and he coughed again before he spoke. "Well, yes. Fact is, he did. That is to say, a mighty long while ago he did."
"I remember," said Lohr. "He never said anything about it that I know of, but seems to me I recollect we had sort of a rumor around the place how you and that man, let's see, what wasn't his name Campbell, that died of typhoid fever? Yeah, that was it, Campbell. Didn't the old man have you and Campbell working some sort of private on some glue proposition or other?"
"Yes, he did," Adams nodded. "I found out a good deal about glue then, too. Been working on it since, I suppose."
"Yes. Kept it in my mind and studied out new things about it."
Lohr looked serious.
"Well, but see here," he said. "I hope it ain't anything the old man'll think might infringe on whatever he had you doing for him. You know how he is, broad-minded, liberal, free-handed man as walks this earth, and if he thought he owed you a cent, he'd sell his right hand for a pork chop to pay it, if that was the only way. But if he got the idea anybody was trying to get the better of him, he'd sell both his hands, if he had to keep him from doing it. Yes, at 80 he would. Not that I mean I think you might be trying to get the better of him, Virg. You're a mighty close old codger, but such a thing ain't in you. What I mean, I hope there ain't any chance for the old man to think you might be—"
"Oh, no," Adams interrupted. "As a matter of fact, I don't believe he'll have ever thought about it at all. And if he did, he wouldn't have any real right to feel offended at me. The process I'm going to use is one I expect to change and improve a lot different from the one Campbell and I worked on for him."
"Well, that's good," said Lohr. "Of course, you know what you're up to. You're old enough, God knows."
He laughed ruefully.
"My, but it will seem funny to me, down there with you gone. I expect you and I both been getting to pretty much deadwood in the place, the way the young fellows look at it, and the only one that'd miss either of us would be the other one. Have you told the old man yet?"
"Well," Adams spoke laboriously, no, I haven't. I thought, well, that's what I wanted to see you about."
"What can I do?"
"I thought I'd write him a letter and get you to hand it to him for me."
"My soul!" his friend exclaimed. "Why on earth don't you just go down there and tell him?"
Adams became piteously embarrassed. He stammered, coughed, stammered again, wrinkling his face so deeply he seemed about to weep, but finally he contrived to utter an apologetic laugh. "I ought to do that, of course, but in some way or other I just don't seem to be able to. I can't manage it."
"Why in the world not?" the mystified Lohr inquired.
"I could hardly tell you. Lesson it is to say that when you've been with one boss all your life, it's so kind of embarrassing to quit him. I just can't make up my mind to go and speak to him about it. No, I got it in my head a letter's the only satisfactory way to do it, and I thought I'd ask you to hand it to him."
"Of course I don't mind doing that for you," Lohr said, mildly. "But why in the world don't you just mail it to him?"
"Well, I'll tell you," Adams returned. "You know, like that, it'd have to go through a clerk and that kind of secretary of his and I don't know who all. There's a couple of kind of delicate points I want to put in it. For instance, I want to explain to him how much improvement and so on I'm going to introduce on the old process I helped to work out with Campbell when we were working for him, so's he'll understand it's a different article and no infringement at all. Then there's another thing. You see, all during while I was sick, he had my salary paid to me. It amounts to considerable, I was on my back so long. Under the circumstances, because I'm quitting, I don't feel as if I ought to accept it, so I'll have to have a check for him in the letter to cover it, and I want to be sure he knows it and gets it personally. If it had to go through a lot of other people, the way it would if I put it in the mail, why, you can't tell. So what I thought, if you'd hand it to him for me, and maybe if he happened to read it right then or anything, it might be you'd notice whatever he happened to say about it, and you could tell me afterward."
"All right," Lohr said. "Certainly, if you'd rather do it that way, I'll hand it to him and tell you what he says. That is, if he says anything, and I hear him." "Got it written?"
"No. I'll send it around to you the last of the week." Adams moved toward his taxicab. "Don't say anything to anybody about it, Charlie, especially till after that."
"All right."
"And, Charlie, I'll be mighty obliged to you," Adams said. And he came back to shake hands and farewell. "There's one more thing you might do. If you ever happen to feel like it..." He kept his eyes rather vaguely fixed on a point above his friend's head as he spoke, and his voice was not well controlled. I've been down there a good many years, and I might not have been so much use lately as I was at first, but I always tried to do my best for the old firm. If anything turned out so's they did kind of take offense with me down there, why, just say a good word for me,
if you happen to feel like it, maybe." Old Charlie Lohr assured him that he would speak a good word if the opportunity became available. Then, after the cab had driven away, he went up to his small apartment on the third floor and muttered ruminatively until his wife inquired what he was talking to himself about. "Old Virg Adams," he told her. "He's out again after his long spell of sickness, and the way it looks to me, he'd have better stayed in bed."
"You mean he still looks too bad to be out?"
"Oh, I expect he's getting his health back," Lohr said, frowning.
"Then what's the matter with him? You mean he's lost his mind?"
"My goodness, women do jump at conclusions," he exclaimed.
"Well," said Mrs. Lohr, "what other conclusion did you leave me to jump at?"
Her husband explained with a little heat. "People can have a sickness that affects their mind, can't it? Their mind can get some affected without being lost, can't it?"
"Then you mean the poor man's mind does seem affected?"
"Well, no, I'd scarcely go as far as that," Lohr said, inconsistently, and declined to be more definite. Adams devoted the latter part of that evening to the composition of his letter, a disquieting task not completed when, at 11 o'clock, he heard his daughter coming up the stairs. She was singing to herself in a low, sweet voice, and Adams paused to listen incredulously, with his pen lifted and his mouth open, as if he heard the strangest sound in the world. Then he set down the pen upon a blotter, went to his door and opened it, looking out at her as she came.
"Well, dearie, you seem to be feeling pretty good," he said. "Where you been?"
"Just sitting out on the front steps, Papa."
"All alone, I suppose?"
"No, Mr. Russell called."
"Oh, he did?"
Adams pretended to be surprised. "What all could you and he find to talk about till this hour of the night?"
She laughed gaily. "You don't know me, Papa."
"How's that?"
"You never found out that I always do all the talking."
"Didn't you let him get a word in all evening?"
"Oh, yes, every now and then."
Adams took her hand and petted it.
"Well, what did he say?"
Alice gave him a radiant look and kissed him.
"Not what you think," she laughed, then slapped his cheek with saucy affection,
pirouetted across the narrow hall and into her own room, and curtsied to him as she closed her door. Adams went back to his writing with a lighter heart, for since Alice was born she had been to him the apple of his eye, his own phrase in thinking of her, and what he was doing now was for her. He smiled as he picked up his pen to begin a new draft of that painful letter, but presently he looked puzzled. After all, she could be happy just as things were, it seemed. Then why had he taken what his wife called this new step, which he had so long resisted? He could only sigh and wonder. Life works out pretty peculiarly, he thought, for he couldn't go back now, though the reason he couldn't was not clearly apparent. He had to go ahead. End of chapter 16. Chapter 17 of Alice Adams. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Jeanie. Alice Adams by Booth Tarkington. Chapter 17. He was out in his taxicab again the next morning, and by noon he had secured what he wanted. It was curiously significant that he worked so quickly. All the years during which his wife had pressed him toward his present shift, he had sworn to himself, as well as to her, that he would never yield. And yet when he did yield, he had no plans to make, because he found them already prepared and worked out in detail in his mind, as if he had long contemplated the step he believed himself incapable of taking. Sometimes he had thought of improving his income by exchanging his little collection of bonds for a small rental property, if he could find a good buy. And he had spent many of his spare hours rambling over the enormously spreading city and its purlieus, looking for the ideal buy. It remained unattainable, so far as he was concerned. But he found other things. Not twice a crow's mile from his own house there was a dismal and slummish quarter, a decayed industrial district of earlier days. Most of the industries were small, some of them died, perishing of bankruptcy or fire, and a few had moved, leaving their shells. Of the relics, the best was a brick building which had been the largest and most important factory in the quarter. It had been injured by a long vacancy, almost as serious as a fire, in effect, and Adams had often guessed at the sum needed to put it into repair. When he passed it, he would look at it with an interest which he supposed detached and idly speculative. That'd be just the thing, he thought. If a fellow had some money and took a notion to set up some new business on a big scale, this would be a pretty good place. To make glue, for instance, if that wasn't out of the question, of course. It would take a lot of money, though, a great deal too much for me to expect to handle, even if I'd ever dream of doing such a thing. Opposite the dismantled factory was a muddy, open lot of 2 acres or so, and near the middle of the lot a long brick shed stood in a desolate abandonment, not happily decorated by old coatings of theatrical and medicinal advertisements. But the brick shed had 2 wooden ells, and though both shed and ells were of a single story, here was empty space enough for a modest enterprise. Space enough for almost anything to start with, Adams thought, as he walked through the low buildings one day when he was prospecting in that section. Yes, I suppose I could swing this, he thought. If the process belonged to me, say, instead of being out of the question because it isn't my property, or if I was the kind of man to do such a thing anyhow, here would be something I could probably get hold of pretty cheap. They'd want a lot of money for a lease on that big building over the way, but this, I should think it would be practically nothing at all. Then, by chance, meeting an agent he knew, he made inquiries, merely to satisfy a casual curiosity, he thought. And he found matters much as he had supposed, except that the owners of the big building did not wish to let, but to sell it, and this at a price so exorbitant that Adams laughed. But the long brick shed in the great muddy lot was for sale or to let, or pretty near to be given away, he learned, if anybody would take it. Adams took it now, though without seeing that he had been destined to take it, and that some dreary wizard in the back of his head had foreseen all along that he would take it, and planned to be ready. He drove in his taxicab to look the place over again, then downtown to arrange for a lease, and came home to lunch with his wife and daughter. Things were moving, he told them. He boasted a little of having acted so decisively, and said that since the dang thing had to be done, it was going to be done right. He was almost cheerful, in a feverish way, and when the cab came for him again, soon after lunch, he explained that he intended not only to get things done right, but also to get 'em done quick. Alice, following him to the front door, looked at him anxiously and asked if she couldn't help. He laughed at her grimly. "Then let me go along with you in the cab," she begged. "You don't look able to start in so hard, Papa, just when you're barely beginning to get your strength back. Do let me go with you and see if I can't help, or at least take care of you if you should get to feeling badly." He declined, but upon pressure let her put a tiny bottle of spirits of ammonia in his pocket and promised to make use of it if he felt faint or anything. Then he was off again, and the next morning had men at work in his sheds, though the wages he had to pay frightened him. He directed the workmen in every detail, hurrying them by example and exhortations, and receiving, in consequence, several declarations of independence, as well as one resignation, which took effect immediately. "You capitalists seem to think a man's got nothing to do but break his back padoozin' wealth for yous to squander," the resigning person loudly complained. "You look out. The toiler's day is a-comin', and it ain't so far off, neither." But the capitalist was already out of hearing, gone to find a man to take this orator's place. By the end of the week, Adams felt that he had moved satisfactorily forward in his preparations for the simple equipment he needed. But he hated the pause of a Sunday. He didn't want any rest, he told Alice, impatiently, when she suggested that the idle day might be good for him. Late that afternoon, he walked over to the apartment house where old Charlie Lohr lived, and gave his friend the letter he wanted the head of Lamb & Company to receive personally. "I'll take it as a mighty great favor in you to hand it to him personally, Charlie," he said, in parting. "And you won't forget, in case he says anything about it. And remember, if you ever do get a chance to put in a good word for me later, you know." Old Charlie promised to remember, and when Mrs. Lohr came out of the kitchenette after the door closed, he said thoughtfully, "Just skin and bones." "You mean Mr. Adams is?" Mrs. Lohr inquired. "What do you think I meant?" he returned. "One of these partridges on the wallpaper?" "Did he look so badly?" "Looked kind of distracted to me," her husband replied. "These little thin fellers can stand a heap sometimes, though. He'll be over here again Monday." "Did he say he would?" "No," said Lohr, "but he will. You'll see. He'll be over to find out what the big boss says when I give him this letter. Expect I'll be kind of anxious myself if I was him." "Why would you? What's Mr. Adams doing to be so anxious about?" Lohr's expression became one of reserve, the look of a man who has found that when he speaks his inner thoughts, his wife jumps too far to conclusions. "Oh, nothing," he said. "Of course, any man starting up a new business is bound to be pretty nervous a while. He'll be over here tomorrow evening, all right. You'll see." The prediction was fulfilled. Adams arrived just after Mrs. Lohr had removed the dinner dishes to her kitchenette, but Lohr had little information to give his caller. "He didn't say a word, Virgil. Nary a word. I took it into his office and handed it to him, and he just sat and read it, that's all. I kind of stood around as long as I could, but he was sitting at his desk with his side to me, and he never turned around full toward me, as it were, so I couldn't hardly even tell anything. All I know, he just read it."
"Well, but see here," Adams began nervously.
"Well..." "Well, what, Virg?"
"Well, but what did he say when he did speak?"
"He didn't speak. Not so long as I was in there, anyhow. He just sat there and read it. Read kind of slow. Then when he came to the end, he turned back and started to read it all over again. By that time, there was three or four other men standing around in the office waiting to speak to him, and I had to go."
Adams sighed and stared at the floor, irresolute.
"Well, I'll be getting along back home then, I guess, Charlie. So you're sure you couldn't tell anything what he might have thought about it, then?"
"Not a thing in the world. I've told you all I know, Virg."
"I guess so, I guess so," Adams said, mournfully. "I feel mighty obliged to you, Charlie Lohr, mighty obliged. Good night to you." And he departed, sighing in perplexity. On his way home, preoccupied with many thoughts, he walked so slowly that once or twice he stopped and stood motionless for a few moments, without being aware of it. And when he reached the juncture of the sidewalk with the short brick path that led to his own front door, he stopped again, and stood for more than a minute. "Ah, I wish I knew," he whispered, plaintively. "I do wish I knew what he thought about it." He was roused by a laugh that came lightly from the little veranda nearby.
"Papa!" Alice called out gaily. "What are you standing there muttering to yourself about?"
"Oh, are you there, sweetie?" he said, and came up the path. A tall figure rose from a chair on the veranda.
"Papa, this is Mr. Russell."
The two men shook hands, Adams saying, "Pleased to make your acquaintance," as they looked at each other in the faint light diffused through the opaque glass in the upper part of the door. Adams' impression was of a strong and tall young man, fashionable but gentle, and Russell's was of a dried little old business man with a grizzled moustache, worried bright eyes, shapeless dark clothes, and a homely manner.
"Nice evening," Adams said further, as their hands parted. "Nice time of year it is, but we don't always have as good weather as this. That's the trouble of it."
"Well," he went to the door. "Well, I bid you good evening," he said, and retired within the house. Alice laughed. "He's the old-fashionedest man in town, I suppose, and frightfully impressed with you, I could see."
"What nonsense," said Russell. "How could anybody be impressed with me?"
"Why not? Because you're quiet? Good gracious! Don't you know that you're the most impressive sort? We chatterers spend all our time playing to you quiet people."
"Yes, we're the only audience."
"Only," she echoed. "Why, we live for you, and we can't live without you."
"I wish you couldn't," said Russell. "That would be a new experience for both of us, wouldn't it?"
"It might be a rather bleak one for me," she answered lightly. "I'm afraid I'll miss these summer evenings with you when they're over. I'll miss them enough, thanks."
"Do they ever have to be over?" he asked.
"Oh, everything's over some time, isn't it?"
Russell laughed at her.
"Don't let's look so far ahead as that," he said. "We don't need to be already thinking of the cemetery, do we?"
"I didn't," she said, shaking her head. "Our summer evenings will be over before then, Mr. Russell."
"Why?" he asked.
"Good heavens," she said. "There's laconic eloquence. Almost a proposal in a single word. Never mind, I shan't hold you to it, but to answer you, well, I'm always looking ahead, and somehow I usually see about how things are coming out."
"Yes," he said, "I suppose most of us do. At least it seems as if we did, because we so seldom feel surprised by the way they do come out. But maybe that's only because life isn't like a play in a theater, and most things come about so gradually we get used to them."
"No, I'm sure I can see quite a long way ahead," she insisted, gravely. "And it doesn't seem to me as if our summer evenings could last very long. Something'll interfere. Somebody will, I mean. They'll say something."
"What if they do?" She moved her shoulders in a little apprehensive shiver.
"It'll change you," she said. "I'm just sure something spiteful's going to happen to me. You'll feel differently about things."
"Now isn't that an idea?" he exclaimed.
"It will," she insisted. "I know something spiteful's going to happen."
"You seem possessed by a notion not a bit flattering to me," he remarked.
"Oh, but isn't it? That's just what it is.
Why isn't it?"
"Because it implies that I'm made of such soft material the slightest breeze will mess me all up. I'm not so like that as I evidently appear, and if it's true that we're afraid other people will do the things we'd most be likely to do ourselves, it seems to me that I ought to be the one to be afraid. I ought to be afraid that somebody may say something about me to you that will make you believe I'm a professional forger."
"No, we both know they won't," she said. "We both know you're the sort of person everybody in the world says nice things about." She lifted her hand to silence him as he laughed about this. "Oh, of course you are. I think perhaps you're a little flirtatious. Most quiet men have that one sly way with them. Oh, yes, they do. But you happen to be the kind of man everybody loves to praise. And if you weren't, I shouldn't hear anything terrible about you. I told you I was unpopular. I don't see anybody at all anymore. The only man except you who's been to see me in a month is that fearful little fat Frank Dowling, and I sent word to him I wasn't home. Nobody would tell me of your wickedness, you see." "Then let me break some news to you," Russell said. "Nobody would tell me of yours, either. Nobody's even mentioned you to me." She burlesqued a cry of anguish. "That is obscurity! I suppose I'm too apt to forget that they say the population's about 500,000 nowadays. There are other people to talk about, you feel that?" "None that I want to," he said. "But I should think the size of the place might relieve your mind of what seems to insist on burdening it. Besides, I'd rather you thought of me a better man than you do." "What kind of a man do I think you are?" "The kind affected by what's said about people instead of by what they do themselves."
"Aren't you?"
"No, I'm not," he said. "If you want our summer evenings to be over, you'll have to drive me away yourself."
"Nobody else could?"
"No." She was silent, leaning forward with her elbows on her knees and her clasped hands against her lips. Then, not moving, she said softly, "Well, I won't." She was silent again, and he said nothing, but looked at her, seeming to be content with looking. Her attitude was one only a graceful person should assume, but she was graceful, and in the wan light, which made a prettily shaped mist of her, she had beauty. Perhaps it was beauty of the hour, and of the love scene almost made into form by what they had both just said, but she had it. And though beauty of the hour passes, he who sees it will long remember it, and the hour when it came. "What are you thinking of?" he asked. She leaned back in her chair and did not answer at once. Then she said, "I don't know. I doubt if I was thinking of anything. It seems to me I wasn't. I think I was just sort of being sadly happy just then."
"Were you? Was it sadly, too?"
"Don't you know," she said. "It seems to me that only little children can be just happily happy. I think when we get older, our happiest moments are like the one I had just then. It's as if we heard strains of minor music running through them. Oh, so sweet, but oh, so sad." "But what makes it sad for you?"
"I don't know," she said, in a lighter tone. "Perhaps it's a kind of useless foreboding I seem to have pretty often. It may be that, or it may be poor Papa."
"You are a funny, delightful girl, though," Russell laughed, "when your father's so well again that he goes out walking in the evenings."
"He does too much walking," Alice said. "Too much altogether, over at his new plant. But there isn't any stopping him."
She laughed and shook her head. "When a man gets an ambition to be a multimillionaire, his family doesn't appear to have much weight with him. He'll walk all he wants to in spite of them."
"I suppose so," Russell said, absently. Then he leaned forward. "I wish I could understand better why you were sadly happy."
Meanwhile, as Alice shed what further light she could on this point, the man ambitious to be a multimillionaire was indeed walking too much for his own good. He had gone to bed, hoping to sleep well and rise early for a long day's work, but he could not rest. And now, in his nightgown and slippers, he was pacing the floor of his room. "I wish I did know," he thought, over and over. "I do wish I knew how he feels about it." End of chapter 17.
Chapter 18 of Alice Adams. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Jeanie. Alice Adams by Booth Tarkington. Chapter 18. That was a thought almost continuously in his mind, even when he was hardest at work. And as the days went on and he could not free himself, he became querulous about it. "I guess I'm the biggest dang fool alive," he told his wife, as they sat together one evening. "I got plenty else to bother me without worrying my head off about what he thinks. I can't help what he thinks. It's too late for that. So why should I keep pestering myself about it?"
"It'll wear off, Virgil," Mrs. Adams said, reassuringly. She was gentle and sympathetic with him, and for the first time in many years he would come to sit with her and talk when he had finished his day's work. He had told her, evading her eye, "Oh, I don't blame you. You didn't get after me to do this on your own account. You couldn't help it."
"Yes, but it don't wear off," he complained. "This afternoon I was showing the men how I wanted my vats to go, and I caught my fool self standing there saying to my fool self, 'It's funny I don't hear how he feels about it from somebody.' I was saying it aloud, almost. And it is funny I don't hear anything." "Well, you see what it means, don't you, Virgil? It only means he hasn't said anything to anybody about it. Don't you think you're getting kind of morbid over it?"
"Maybe, maybe," he muttered.
"Why, yes," she said, briskly. "You don't realize what a little bit of a thing all this is to him. It's been a long, long while since the last time you even mentioned glue to him, and he's probably forgotten everything about it." "You're off your base. It isn't like him to forget things," Adams returned, peevishly. "He may seem to forget 'em, but he don't." "But he's not thinking about this, or you'd have heard from him before now." Her husband shook his head. "That's just it," he said. "Why haven't I heard from him?" "It's all your morbidness, Virgil. Look at Walter. If Mr. Lamb held this up against you, would he still let Walter stay there? Wouldn't he have discharged Walter if he felt angry with you?" "That dang boy," Adams said. "If he wanted to come with me now, I wouldn't hardly let him. What do you suppose makes him so bullheaded?" "But hasn't he the right to choose for himself?" she asked. "I suppose he feels he ought to stick to what he thinks is sure pay. As soon as he sees that you're going to succeed with the glue works, he'll want to be with you quick enough." "Well, he better get a little sense in his head," Adams returned, crossly. "He wanted me to pay him a $300 bonus in advance when anybody with a grain of common sense knows I need every penny I can lay my hands on." "Never mind," she said. "He'll come around later and be glad of the chance." "He'll have to beg for it then. I won't ask him again." "Oh, Walter will come out all right. You needn't worry. And don't you see that Mr. Lamb's not discharging him means that there's no hard feelings against you, Virgil?" "I can't make it out at all," he said, frowning. "The only thing I can think it means is that J. A. Lamb is so fair-minded, and of course he is one of the fair-mindedest men alive. I suppose that's the reason he hasn't fired Walter. He may know," Adams concluded morosely, "he may know that's just another thing to make me feel all the meaner, keeping my boy there on a salary after I've done him an injury." "Now, now," she said, trying to comfort him. "You couldn't do anybody an injury to save your life, and everybody knows it." "Well, anybody ought to know I wouldn't want to do an injury, but this world isn't built so's we can do just what we want." He paused, reflecting. "Of course, there may be one explanation of why Walter's still there. J.A. maybe hasn't noticed that he is there. There's so many I expect he hardly knows him by sight." "Well, just do quit thinking about it," she urged him. "It only bothers you without doing any good. Don't you know that?" "Don't I, though?" he laughed, feebly. "I know it better'n anybody. How funny that is, when you know thinking about a thing only pesters you without helping anything at all, yet you keep right on pestering yourself with it." "But why?" she said. "What's the use when you know you haven't done anything wrong, Virgil? You said yourself you were going to improve the process so much it would be really different from the old one, and you'd really have a right to it." Adams had persuaded himself of this when he yielded. He had found it necessary to persuade himself of it, though there was a part of him, of course, that remained unpersuaded. And this discomforting part of him was what made his present trouble. "Yes, I know," he said. "That's true. But I can't quite seem to get away from the fact that the principle of the process is a good deal the same. Well, it's more than that. It's just about the same as the one he hired Campbell and me to work out for him. Truth is, nobody could tell the difference, and I don't know as there is any difference, except in these improvements I'm making. Of course, the improvements do give me pretty near a perfect right to it, as a person might say, and that's one of the things I thought of putting in my letter to him, but I was afraid he'd just think I was trying to make up excuses, so I left it out. I kind of worried all the time I was writing that letter, because if he thought I was just making up excuses, why, it might set him just so much more against me." Ever since Mrs. Adams had found that she was to have her way, the depths of her eyes had been troubled by a continuous uneasiness. And although she knew it was there, and sometimes veiled it by keeping the revealing eyes averted from her husband and children, she could not always cover it under the assumption of absent-mindedness. The uneasy look became vivid, and her voice was slightly tremulous now as she said, "But what if he should be against you? Although I don't believe he is, of course. You told me he couldn't do anything to you, Virgil." "No," he said slowly. "I can't see how he could do anything. It was just a secret, not a patent. The thing ain't patentable. I've tried to think what he could do, supposing he was to want to, but I can't figure out anything at all that would be any harm to me. There isn't any way in the world it could be made a question of law. Only thing he could do would be to tell people his side of it and set 'em against me. I've been kind of waiting for that to happen all along." She looked somewhat relieved.
"So did I expect it," she said. "I was dreading it most on Alice's account. It might have... Well, young men are so easily influenced and all. But so far as the business is concerned, what if Mr. Lamb did talk? That wouldn't amount to much. It wouldn't affect the business, not to hurt. And besides, he isn't even doing that."
"No, anyhow not yet, it seems."
And Adams sighed again, wistfully. "But I would give a good deal to know what he thinks."
Before his surrender, he had always supposed that if he did such an unthinkable thing as to seize upon the glue process for himself, what he would feel must be an overpowering shame. But shame is the rarest thing in the world. What he felt was this unremittent curiosity about his old employer's thoughts. It was an obsession, yet he did not want to hear what Lamb thought from Lamb himself, for Adams had a second obsession, and this was his dread of meeting the old man face to face. Such an encounter could happen only by chance and unexpectedly, since Adams would have avoided any deliberate meeting so long as his legs had strength to carry him, even if Lamb came up to the house to see him. But people do meet unexpectedly, and when Adams had to be downtown he kept away from the wholesale district. One day he did see Lamb as the latter went by in his car, impassive, going home to lunch, and Adams, in the crowd at a corner, knew that the old man had not seen him. Nevertheless, in a streetcar on the way back to his sheds an hour later, he was still subject to little shivering seizures of horror. He worked unceasingly, seeming to keep at it even in his sleep, for he always woke in the midst of a planning and estimating that must have been going on in his mind before consciousness of himself returned. Moreover, the work, thus urged, went rapidly, in spite of the high wages he had to pay his laborers for their short hours. "It eats money," he complains. And in fact, by the time his vats and boilers were in place, it had eaten almost all he could supply. But, in addition to his equipment, he now owned a stock of raw material. Raw, indeed. And when operations should be a little further along, he was confident his banker would be willing to carry him. 6 weeks from the day he had obtained his lease, he began his glue-making. The terrible smells came out of the shed and went writhing like snakes all through that quarter of the town. A smiling man, strolling and breathing the air with satisfaction, would turn a corner and smile no more, but hurry. However, colored people had almost all the dwellings of this old section to themselves, and although even they were troubled, there was recompense for them. Being philosophic about what appeared to them as in the order of nature, they sought neither escape nor redress, and soon learned to bear what the wind brought them. They even made use of it to enrich those figures of speech with which the native impulses of colored people decorate their communications. They flavored metaphor, simile, and invective with it, and thus may be said to have enjoyed it. But the man who produced it took a hot bath as soon as he reached his home the evening of that first day when his manufacturing began. Then he put on fresh clothes, but after dinner he seemed to be haunted, and asked his wife if she noticed anything. She laughed and inquired what he meant. "Seems to me as if that glue-work spell hadn't quit hanging on to me," he explained. "Don't you notice it?"
"No, what an idea!"
He laughed, too, but uneasily, and told her he was sure the dang glue-smell was somehow sticking to him. Later he went outdoors and walked up and down the small yard in the dusk, but now and then he stood still, with his head lifted, and sniffed the air suspiciously. "Can you smell it?" he called to Alice, who sat upon the veranda, prettily dressed and waiting in a reverie.
"Smell what, Papa?"
"The dang glue works." She did the same thing her mother had done, laughed, and said, "No, how foolish. Why, Papa, it's over 2 miles from here."
"You don't get it at all?" he insisted.
"The idea! The air is lovely tonight, Papa." The air did not seem lovely to him, for he was positive that he smelled the taint. He wondered how far it carried, and if J. A. Lamb would smell it too, out on his own lawn a mile to the north. And if he did, would he guess what it was? Then Adams laughed at himself for such nonsense, but could not rid his nostrils of their disgust. To him the whole town seemed to smell of his glue-works. Nevertheless, the glue was making, and his sheds were busy. "Guess we're stirring up this old neighborhood with more than the smell," his foreman remarked one morning.
"How's that?" Adams inquired.
"That great big enormous old dead butterine factory across the street from our lot," the man said. "Nothing like setting an example to bring real estate to life. That place is full of carpenters getting it ready to make a regular building again. Guess you ought to have the credit of it, because you was the first man in 10 years to see any possibilities in this neighborhood." Adams was pleased, and going out to see for himself, heard a great hammering and sawing from within the building, while carpenters were just emerging gingerly upon the dangerous roof. He walked out over the dried mud of his deep lot, across the street and spoke genially to a workman who was removing the broken glass of a window on the ground floor. "Here, what's all this howdy-do over here?"
"Gonna fix her all up, I guess," the workman said.
"Big job it is, too."
"Should think it would be."
"Yes, sir, a pretty big job. Pretty big job. Got men at it on all four floors and on the roof. They're doing it right."
"Who's doing it?"
"Lord, I dunno. Some of these here big manufacturing corporations, I guess."
"What's it going to be?"
"They tell me," the workman answered, "they tell me she's going to be a butterine factory again. Anyways, I hope she won't be anything to smell like that glue works you got over there, not while I'm working around her anyways."
"That smells all right," Adams said. "You soon get used to it."
"You do?"
The man appeared incredulous. "Listen, I was over in France. It's a good thing them Dutchmen never thought of it. We'd have had to quit."
Adams laughed and went back to his sheds.
"I guess my foreman was right," he told his wife that evening, with a little satisfaction. "As soon as one man shows enterprise enough to found an industry in a broken-down neighborhood, somebody else is sure to follow. I kind of like the look of it. It'll help make our place seem sort of more busy and prosperous when it comes to getting a loan from the bank, and I got to get one mighty soon, too. I did think some that if things go as well as there's every reason to think they ought to, I might want to spread out and maybe get hold of that old factory myself, but I hardly expected to be able to handle a proposition of that size before 2 or 3 years from now. And anyhow, there's room enough on the lot I got if we need more buildings some day. Things are going about as fine as I could ask. I hired some girls today to do the bottling, colored girls along about 16 to 20 years old. After a while, I expect to get a machine to put the stuff in the little bottles, when we begin to get good returns, but half a dozen of these colored girls can do it all right now, by hand. We're getting to have really quite a little plant over there. Yes, sir, quite a regular little plant." He chuckled, and at this cheerful sound, of a kind his wife had almost forgotten he was capable of producing, she ventured to put her hand upon his arm. They had gone outdoors after dinner, taking 2 chairs with them, and were sitting through the late twilight together, keeping well away from the front porch, which was not yet occupied, however. Alice was in her room, changing her dress.
"Well, honey," Mrs. Adams said, taking confidence not only to put her hand upon his arm, but to revive this disused endearment. "It's grand to have you so optimistic. Maybe sometime you'll admit I was right after all. Everything's going so well it seems a pity you didn't take this step long ago. Don't you think maybe so, Virgil?"
"Well, if I was ever going to, I don't know but I might as well have. I got to admit, the proposition begins to look pretty good. I know the stuff'll sell, and I can't see a thing in the world to stop it. It does look good, and if—" He paused.
"If what?" she said, anxious.
He laughed plaintively, as if confessing a superstition. "It's funny. Well, it's mighty funny about that smell. I've got so used to it at the plant, I never seem to notice it at all over here. It's only when I get away. Honestly, can't you notice?"
"Virgil!" She lifted her hand to strike his arm chidingly. "Do quit harping on that nonsense."
"Oh, of course it don't amount to anything," he said. "A person can stand a good deal at just smell. It don't worry me any."
"I should think not, especially as there isn't any."
"Well," he said, "I feel pretty fair over the whole thing. A lot better'n I ever expected to, anyhow. I don't know as there's any reason I shouldn't tell you so."
She was deeply pleased with this acknowledgment, and her voice had tenderness in it as she responded, "There, honey, didn't I always say you'd be glad if you did it?"
Embarrassed, he coughed loudly, then filled his pipe and lit it.
"Well," he said slowly, "it's a puzzle."
"Yes, sir, it's a puzzle."
"What is?"
"Pretty much everything, I guess."
As he spoke, a song came to them from a lighted window over their heads. Then the window darkened abruptly, but the song continued as Alice went down through the house to wait on the little veranda. "Mi chiamo Mimi," she sang, and in her voice throbbed something almost startling in its sweetness. Her father and mother listened, not speaking until the song stopped with the click of the wire screen at the front door as Alice came out.
"My," said her father, "how sweet she does sing! I don't know as I ever heard her voice sound nicer than it did just then."
"There's something that makes it sound that way," his wife told him.
"I suppose so," he said, sighing. "I suppose so. You think—"
"She's just terribly in love with him."
"I expect that's the way it ought to be," he said. Then he drew upon his pipe for reflection and became murmurous with the symptoms of melancholy laughter. "It don't make things less of a puzzle, though, does it?"
"In what way, Virgil?"
"Why, here," he said. "Here we go through all this muck and moil to help fix things nicer for her at home, and what's it all amount to? Seems like she's just gone ahead the way she'd have gone anyhow, and now, I suppose, getting ready to up and leave us.
Ain't that a puzzle to you?
It is to me.
Oh, but things haven't gone that far yet.
Why, you just said.
She gave a little cry of protest.
Oh, they aren't engaged yet. Of course they will be. He's just as much interested in her as she is in him, but...
Well, what's the trouble, then?
You are a simple old fellow, his wife exclaimed, and then rose from her chair. That reminds me, she said.
What of? He asked. What's my being simple remind you of?
Nothing, she laughed. It wasn't you that reminded me. It was just something that's been on my mind. I don't believe he's actually ever been inside our house.
Hasn't he?
I actually don't believe he ever has, she said. Of course we must.
She paused, debating.
We must what?
I guess I better talk to Alice about it right now, she said. He don't usually come for about half an hour yet. I guess I've got time. And with that, she walked away, leaving him to his puzzles. End of chapter 18.
Chapter 19 of Alice Adams. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Jeannie. Alice Adams by Booth Tarkington. Chapter 19. Alice was softly crooning to herself as her mother turned the corner of the house and approached through the dusk. "Isn't it the most beautiful evening?" the daughter said. "Why can't summer last all year? Did you ever know a lovelier twilight than this, Mama?" Mrs. Adams laughed and answered, "Not since I was your age, I expect." Alice was wistful at once. "Don't they stay beautiful after my age?"
"Well, it's not the same thing."
"Isn't it? Not ever?"
"You may have a different kind from mine," the mother said, a little sadly. "I think you will, Alice. You deserve—"
"No, I don't. I don't deserve anything, and I know it. But I'm getting a great deal these days, more than I ever dreamed could come to me. I'm pretty happy, Mama."
"Dearie."
Her mother would have kissed her, but Alice drew away.
"Oh, I don't mean—"
She laughed nervously. "I wasn't meaning to tell you I'm engaged, Mama. We're not. I mean, oh, things seem pretty beautiful in spite of all I've done to spoil 'em."
"You?" Mrs. Adams cried incredulously. "What have you done to spoil things?"
"Little things," Alice said. "A thousand little silly— oh, what's the use? He's so honestly what he is, just simple and good and intelligent. I feel a tricky mess beside him. I don't see why he likes me, and sometimes I'm afraid he wouldn't if he knew me."
"He'd just worship you," said the fond mother. "And the more he knew you, the more he'd worship you."
Alice shook her head. "He's not the worshipping kind. Not like that at all. He's more—" But Mrs. Adams was not interested in this analysis, and she interrupted briskly. "Of course it's time your father and I showed some interest in him. I was just saying I actually don't believe he's ever been inside the house."
"No," Alice said, musingly. "That's true. I don't believe he has. Except when we've walked in the evening, we always sat here, even those two times when it was drizzly. It's so much nicer."
"We'll have to do something or other, of course," her mother said.
"What like?"
"I was thinking—" Mrs. Adams paused. "Well, of course, we could hardly put off asking him to dinner, or something, much longer." Alice was not enthusiastic. So far from it, indeed, that there was a melancholy alarm in her voice.
"Oh, Mama, must we? Do you think so?"
"Yes, I do. I really do."
Couldn't we wait?"
"It looks queer," Mrs. Adams said. "It isn't the thing at all for a young man to come as much as he does, and never more than just barely meet your father and mother. No, we ought to do something."
"But a dinner," Alice objected. "In the first place, there isn't anybody I want to ask. There isn't anybody I would ask."
"I don't mean trying to give a big dinner," her mother explained. "I just mean having him to dinner. That mulatto woman, Melena Burns, goes out by the day, and she could bring a waitress. We can get some flowers for the table and just some to put in the living room. We might just as well go ahead and do it tomorrow as any other time, because your father's in a fine mood, and I saw Melena this afternoon and told her I might want her soon. She said she didn't have any engagements this week, and I can let her know tonight. Suppose when he comes you ask him for tomorrow, Alice. Everything'll be very nice, I'm sure. Don't worry about it."
"Well, but—"
Alice was uncertain.
"But don't you see it looks so queer not to do something?" her mother urged. "It looks so kind of poverty-stricken. We really oughtn't to wait any longer."
Alice assented, though not with a good heart.
"Very well. I'll ask him if you think we've got to."
"That matter's settled, then," Mrs. Adams said. "I'll go telephone Melena, and then I'll tell your father about it." But when she went back to her husband, she found him in an excited state of mind, and Walter standing before him in the darkness. Adams was almost shouting, so great was his vehemence.
"Hush, hush," his wife implored as she came near them. "They'll hear you out on the front porch."
"I don't care who hears me," Adams said harshly, though he tempered his loudness. "Do you want to know what this boy's asking me for? I thought he'd maybe come to tell me he's got a little sense in his head at last, and a little decency about what's due his family. I thought he was going to ask me to take him into my plant. No, ma'am, that's not what he wants."
"No, it isn't," Walter said.
In the darkness his face could not be seen. He stood motionless in what seemed an apathetic attitude, and he spoke quietly.
"No," he repeated, "that isn't what I want."
"You stay down at that place," Adams went on hotly, "instead of trying to be a little use to your family, and the only reason you're allowed to stay is because Mr. Lamb's never been able to notice that you're still there. You just wait."
"You're off," Walter said, in the same quiet way.
"He knows I'm there. He spoke to me yesterday. He asked me how I was getting along in my work."
"He did?"
Adams asked, seeming not to believe him.
"Yes, he did."
"What else did he say, Walter?" Mrs. Adams asked quickly.
"Nothing. Just walked on."
"I don't believe he knew who you were," Adams declared.
"Think not? He called me Walter Adams."
At this, Adams was silent, and Walter, after waiting a moment, said,
"Well, are you going to do anything about me? About what I told you I got to have?"
"What is it, Walter?" his mother asked, since Adams did not speak.
Walter cleared his throat and replied in a tone as quiet as that he had used before, though with a slight huskiness.
"I got to have $350. You better get him to give it to me if you can."
Adams found his voice.
"Yes," he said bitterly, "that's all he asks. He won't do anything I ask him to, and in return he asks me for $350, that's all."
"What in the world?" Mrs. Adams exclaimed. "What for, Walter?"
"I got to have it," Walter said.
"But what for?"
His quiet huskiness did not alter.
"I got to have it."
"But can't you tell us? I got to have it."
"That's all you can get out of him," Adams said. "He seems to think it'll bring him in $350.
A faint tremulousness became evident in the husky voice.
"Haven't you got it?"
"No, I haven't got it," his father answered, "and I've got to go to a bank for more than my payroll next week. Do you think I'm a mint?"
"I don't understand what you mean, Walter," Mrs. Adams interposed, perplexed and distressed.
"If your father had the money, of course he'd need every cent of it, especially just now, and anyhow you could scarcely expect him to give it to you unless you told us what you want with it. But he hasn't got it."
"All right," Walter said, and after standing a moment more in silence, he added impersonally, "I don't see as you ever did anything much for me anyhow, either of you."
Then, as if this were his valedictory, he turned his back upon them, walked away quickly, and was at once lost to their sight in the darkness.
"There's a fine boy to have had the trouble of raising," Adams grumbled. "Just crazy, that's all."
"What in the world do you suppose he wants all that money for?" his wife said wonderingly. "I can't imagine what he could do with it. I wonder..." She paused.
"I wonder if he..."
"If he what?" Adams prompted her, irritably.
"If he could have bad associates."
"God knows," said Adams. "I don't. It just looks to me like he had something in him I don't understand. You can't keep your eye on a boy all the time in a city this size, not a boy Walter's age. You got a girl pretty much in the house, but a boy'll follow his nature. I don't know what to do with him."
Mrs. Adams brightened a little.
"He'll come out all right," she said. "I'm sure he will. I'm sure he'd never be anything really bad. And he'll come around all right about the glue works, too, you'll see. Of course, every young man wants money. It doesn't prove he's doing anything wrong just because he asks for it."
"No, all it proves to me is that he hasn't got any good sense, asking me for $350, when he knows as well as you do the position I'm in. If I wanted to, I could hardly let him have 350 cents, let alone dollars."
"I'm afraid you'll have to let me have that much, and maybe a little more," she ventured, timidly. And she told him of her plans for the morrow. He objected vehemently.
"Oh, but Alice has probably asked him by this time," Mrs. Adams said. "It really must be done, Virgil. You don't want him to think she's ashamed of us, do you?"
"Well, go ahead, but just let me stay away," he begged. "Of course I'll expect to undergo a kind of talk with him when he gets ready to say something to us about Alice, but I do hate to have to sit through a fashionable dinner."
"Why, it isn't going to bother you," she said. "Just one young man as a guest."
"Yes, I know, but you want us to have all this fancy cooking, and I can see well enough you're going to get that old dress suit out of the cedar chest in the attic and try to make me put it on."
"I do think you better, Virgil."
"I hope the moths have got it," he said. "Last time I wore it was to the banquet, and it was pretty old then. Of course, I don't mind wearing it to the banquet so much, because that was what you might call quite an occasion."
He spoke with some reminiscent complacency.
The banquet, an affair now 5 years past, having provided the one time in his life when he had been so distinguished among his fellow citizens as to receive an invitation to be present, with some 700 others, at the annual eating and speech-making of the city's Chamber of Commerce. "Anyhow, as you say, I think it would look foolish of me to wear a dress suit for just one young man," he went on, protesting feebly. "What's the use of all so much howdy-do, anyway? You don't expect him to believe we put on all that style every night, do you? Is that what you're after?"
"Well, we want him to think we live nicely," she admitted.
"So that's it," he said, querulously. "You want him to think that's our regular gait, do you? Well, he'll know better about me, no matter how you fix me up, because he saw me in my regular suit the evening she introduced me to him, and he could tell anyway I'm not one of these moving-picture sporting men that's always got a dress suit on. Besides, you and Alice certainly have some idea he'll come again, haven't you? If they get these things settled between 'em, he'll be around the house and to meals most any time, won't he? You don't hardly expect to put on style all the time, I guess. Well, he'll see then that this kind of thing was all show-off and bluff, won't he? What about it?"
"Oh, well, by that time—"
She left the sentence unfinished, as if absently. "You could let us have a little money for tomorrow, couldn't you, honey?"
"Oh, I reckon," he mumbled. "A girl like Alice is some comfort. She don't come around acting as if she'd commit suicide if she didn't get $350 in the next 5 minutes. I expect I can spare $5 or $6 for you to show off if I got to."
However, she finally obtained 15 before his bedtime, and the next morning went to market after breakfast, leaving Alice to make the beds. Walter had not yet come downstairs.
"You'd better call him," Mrs. Adams said, as she departed with a big basket on her arm. "I expect he's pretty sleepy. He was out so late last night I didn't hear him come in, though I kept awake till after midnight, listening for him. Tell him he'll be late for work if he doesn't hurry, and see that he drinks his coffee, even if he hasn't time for anything else. And when Malena comes, get her started in the kitchen. Show her where everything is."
She waved her hand as she set out for a corner where the car stopped. "Everything'll be lovely. Don't forget about Walter." Nevertheless, Alice did forget about Walter for a few minutes. She closed the door, went into the living room absently, and stared vaguely at one of the old brown plush rocking chairs there. Upon her forehead were the little shadows of an apprehensive reverie, and her thoughts overlapped one another in a fretful jumble. "What will he think? These old chairs, they're hideous. I'll scrub those soot streaks out of the columns. It won't do any good, though. That long crack in the column, nothing can help that. What will he think of Papa? I hope Mama won't talk too much. When he thinks of Mildred's house, or of Henrietta's, or any of 'em beside this. She said she'd buy plenty of roses, that ought to help some. Nothing could be done about those horrible chairs, can't take 'em up in the attic, a room's got to have chairs. Might have rented some. No, if he ever comes again, he'll see they weren't here. If he comes again, oh, it won't be that bad. But it won't be what he expects. I'm responsible for what he expects. He expects just what the airs I've put on have made him expect. What did I want to pose so to him for, as if Papa were a wealthy man and all that? What will he think? The photograph of the Colosseum's a rather good thing, though. It helps some, as if we'd bought it in Rome, perhaps. I hope he'll think so. He believes I've been abroad, of course. The other night, he said, you remember the feeling you get in the Sainte-Chapelle? There's another lie of mine, not saying I didn't remember because I'd never been there. What makes me do it? Papa must wear his evening clothes, but Walter... With that, she recalled her mother's admonition and went upstairs to Walter's door. She tapped upon it with her fingers. "Time to get up, Walter. The rest of us have had breakfast over half an hour ago, and it's nearly 8 o'clock. You'll be late. Hurry down, and I'll have some coffee and toast ready for you." There came no sound from within the room, so she rapped louder. "Wake up, Walter." She called and rapped again without getting any response, and then, finding that the door yielded to her, she opened it and went in. Walter was not there. He had been there, however, had slept upon the bed, though not inside the covers, and Alice supposed he must have come home so late that he had been too sleepy to take off his clothes. Near the foot of the bed was a shallow closet where he kept his other suit and his evening clothes, and the door stood open, showing a bare wall. Nothing whatever was in the closet, and Alice was rather surprised at this for a moment. "That's queer," she murmured. And then she decided that, when he woke, he found the clothes he had slept in so mussy he had put on his other suit, and had gone out before breakfast with the mussed clothes to have them pressed, taking his evening things with them. Satisfied with this explanation, and failing to observe that it did not account for the absence of shoes from the closet floor, she nodded absently. Yes, that must be it. And when her mother returned, told her that Walter had probably breakfasted downtown. They did not delay over this. The colored woman had arrived, and the basket's disclosures were important. "I stopped at Warlig's on the way back," said Mrs. Adams, flushed with hurry and excitement. "I bought a can of caviar there. I thought we'd have little sandwiches brought into the living room before dinner, the way you said they did when you went to that dinner at the..."
"But I think that was to go with cocktails, Mama, and of course we haven't..."
"No," Mrs. Adams said. "Still, I think it would be nice. We can make them look very dainty on a tray, and the waitress can bring them in. I thought we'd have the soup already on the table, and we can walk right out as soon as we have the sandwiches, so it won't get cold. Then, after the soup, Malena says she can make sweetbread pâtés with mushrooms, and for the meat course we'll have larded fillet. Malena's really a fancy cook, you know, and she says she can do anything like that to perfection. We'll have peas with the fillet, and potato balls, and Brussels sprouts. Brussels sprouts are fashionable now, they told me, at the market. Then will come the chicken salad, and after that the ice cream. She's going to make an angel food cake to go with it. And then coffee, and crackers, and a new kind of cheese I got at Warlig's. He says it's very fine." Alice was alarmed. "Don't you think perhaps it's too much, Mama?" "It's better to have too much than too little," her mother said, cheerfully. "We don't want 'em to think we're that kind of skimp. Lord knows we have to enough, though, most of the time. Get the flowers and water, child. I bought 'em at market because they're so much cheaper there, but they'll keep fresh and nice. You fix 'em any way you want. Now hurry. It's got to be a busy day." She had bought 3 dozen little roses. Alice took them and began to arrange them in vases, keeping the stems separated as far as possible so that the clumps would look larger. She put 6 in each of 3 vases in the living room, placing 1 vase on the table in the center of the room and 1 at each end of the mantelpiece. Then she took the rest of the roses to the dining room, but she postponed the arrangement of them until the table should be set just before dinner. She was thoughtful, planning to dry the stems and lay them on the tablecloth like a vine of roses running in a delicate design, if she found that the 12 she had left were enough for that. If they weren't, she would arrange them in a vase. She looked a long time at the little roses in the basin of water where she had put them. Then she sighed and went away to heavier tasks, while her mother worked in the kitchen with Malena. Alice dusted the living room and the dining room vigorously, though all the time with a look that grew more and more pensive. And, having dusted everything, she wiped the furniture, rubbed it hard. After that, she washed the floors and the woodwork. Emerging from the kitchen at noon, Mrs. Adams found her daughter on hands and knees, scrubbing the bases of the columns between the hall and the living room. "Now, dearie," she said, "you mustn't tire yourself out, and you'd better come and eat something. Your father said he'd get a bite downtown today. He was going down to the bank, and Walter eats downtown all the time lately, so I thought we wouldn't bother to set the table for lunch. Come on, and we'll have something in the kitchen." "No," Alice said dully, as she went on with her work. "I don't want anything." Her mother came closer to her. "Why, what's the matter?" she said briskly. "You seem kind of pale to me, and you don't look happy." "Well," Alice began uncertainly, but said no more. "See here," Mrs. Adams exclaimed. "This is all just for you. You ought to be enjoying it. Why, it's the first time we've entertained, and I don't know how long. I guess it's almost since we had that little party when you were 18. Now, what's the matter with you?"
"Nothing. I don't know."
"But, dearie, aren't you looking forward to this evening?" The girl looked up, showing a pallid and solemn face. "Oh, yes, of course," she said, and tried to smile. "Of course we had to do it. I do think it'll be nice. Of course I'm looking forward to it." End of chapter 19. Chapter 20 of Alice Adams. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Jeanie. Alice Adams by Booth Tarkington. Chapter 20. She was indeed looking forward to that evening, but in a cloud of apprehension. And although she could never have guessed it, this was the simultaneous condition of another person, none other than the guest for whose pleasure so much cooking and scrubbing seemed to be necessary. Moreover, Mr. Arthur Russell's premonitions were no product of mere coincidence. Neither had any magical sympathy produced them. His state of mind was rather the result of rougher undercurrents, which had all the time been running beneath the surface of a romantic friendship. Never shrewder than when she analyzed the gentleman, Alice did not libel him when she said that he was one of those quiet men who are a bit flirtatious, by which she meant that he was a bit susceptible, the same thing. And he had proved himself susceptible to Alice upon his first sight of her. "There," he said to himself, "who's that?" And in the crowd of girls at his cousin's dance, all strangers to him, she was the one he wanted to know. Since then, his summer evenings with her had been as secluded as if, for 3 hours after the falling of dusk, they two had drawn apart from the world to some dear bower of their own.
The little veranda was that glamorous nook, with a faint golden light falling through the glass of the closed door upon Alice, and darkness elsewhere, except for the one round globe of the street lamp at the corner. The people who passed along the sidewalk now and then were only shadows with voices, moving vaguely under the maple trees that loomed in obscure contours against the stars. So, as the two sat together, the back of the world was the wall and closed door behind them, and Russell, when he was away from Alice, always thought of her as sitting there before the closed door. A glamour was about her thus, and a spell upon him, but he had a formless anxiety never put into words. All the pictures of her in his mind stopped at the closed door. He had another anxiety, and for the greater part this was of her own creating. She had too often asked him, no matter how gaily, what he had heard about her, too often begged him not to hear anything. Then, hoping to forestall whatever he might hear, she had been at too great pains to account for it, to discredit and mock it. And, though he laughed at her for this, telling her truthfully he did not even hear her mentioned, the everlasting irony that deals with all such human forefendings prevailed. Lately he had half confessed to her what a nervousness she had produced. "You make me dread the day when I'll hear somebody speaking of you. You're getting me so upset about it that if I ever hear anybody so much as say the name Alice Adams, I'll run." The confession was but half of one because he laughed, and she took it for an assurance of loyalty in the form of burlesque. She misunderstood. He laughed, but his nervousness was genuine. After any stroke of events, whether a happy one or a catastrophe, we see that the materials for it were a long time gathering, and the only marvel is that the stroke was not prophesied. What bore the air of fatal coincidence may remain fatal indeed to this later view, but with the haphazard aspect dispelled, there is left for scrutiny the same ancient hint from the infinite to the effect that, since events have never yet failed to be law-abiding, perhaps it were well for us to deduce that they will continue to be so until further notice. On the day that was to open the closed door in the background of his pictures of Alice, Russell lunched with his relatives. There were but the four people, Russell and Mildred and her mother and father, in the great cool dining-room. Arched French windows, shaded by awnings, admitted a mellow light and looked out upon a green lawn ending in a long conservatory, which revealed through its glass panes a carnival of plants in luxuriant blossom. From his seat at the table, Russell glanced out at this pretty display and informed his cousins that he was surprised. "You have such a glorious spread of flowers all over the house," he said. "I didn't suppose you'd have any left for out yonder. In fact, I didn't know there were so many splendid flowers in the world." Mrs. Palmer, large, calm, fair, like her daughter, responded with a mild reproach. "That's because you haven't been cousinly enough to get used to them, Arthur. You've almost taught us to forget what you look like." In defense, Russell waved a hand toward her husband. "You see, he's begun to keep me so hard at work." But Mr. Palmer declined the responsibility. "Up to 4 or 5 in the afternoon, perhaps," he said. "After that, the young gentleman is as much a stranger to me as he is to my family. I've been wondering who she could be." "When a man's preoccupied, there must be a lady, then?" Russell inquired. "That seems to be the view of your sex," Mrs. Palmer suggested. "It was my husband who said it, not Mildred or I." Mildred smiled faintly. "Papa may be singular in his ideas. They may come entirely from his own experience and have nothing to do with Arthur." "Thank you, Mildred," her cousin said, bowing to her gratefully. "You seem to understand my character, and your father's, quite as well." However, Mildred remained grave in the face of this customary pleasantry, not because the old jest, worn round, like what preceded it, rolled in an old groove, but because of some preoccupation of her own. Her faint smile had disappeared, and, as her cousin's glance met hers, she looked down, yet not before he had seen in her eyes the flicker of something like a question both poignant and dismayed. He may have understood it, for his own smile vanished at once in favor of a reciprocal solemnity. "You see, Arthur," Mrs. Palmer said, "Mildred is always a good cousin. She and I stand by you, even if you do stay away from us for weeks and weeks." Then, observing that he appeared to be so occupied with a bunch of iced grapes upon his plate that he had not heard her, she began to talk to her husband, asking him what was going on downtown. Arthur continued to eat his grapes, but he ventured to look again at Mildred after a few moments. She also appeared to be occupied with a bunch of grapes, though she ate none, and only pulled them from their stems. She sat straight, her features as composed and pure as those of a new marble saint in a cathedral niche. yet her downcast eyes seemed to conceal many thoughts, and her cousin, against his will, was more aware of what these thoughts might be than of the leisurely conversation between her father and mother. All at once, however, he heard something that startled him, and he listened. And here was the effect of all Alice's forefendings. He listened from the first with a sinking heart. Mr. Palmer, mildly amused by what he was telling his wife, had just spoken the words, "This Virgil Adams." What he had said was, "This Virgil Adams, that's the man's name. Queer case." "Who told you?" Mrs. Palmer inquired, not much interested. "Alfred Lamb," her husband answered. "He was laughing about his father at the club. You see, the old gentleman takes a great pride in his judgment of men, and always boasted to his sons that he had never in his life made a mistake in trusting the wrong man. Now Alfred and James Albert, Jr., think that they may have a great joke on him, and they've twitted him so much about it that he'll scarcely speak to them. From the first, Alfred says, the old chap's only repartee was, 'You wait and you'll see.' And they've asked him so often to show them what they're going to see that he won't say anything at all." "He's a funny old fellow," Mrs. Palmer observed, "but he's shrewd. I can't imagine his being deceived for such a long time. 20 years, you said?" "Yes, longer than that, I understand. It appears when this man, this Adams, was a young clerk, the old gentleman trusted him with one of his business secrets, a glue process that Mr. Lamb had spent some money to get hold of. The old chap thought this Adams was going to have quite a future with the Lamb concern, and of course never dreamed he was dishonest. Alfred said this Adams hasn't been of any real use for years, and they should have let him go as deadwood. But the old gentleman wouldn't hear of it, and insisted on his being kept on the payroll, so they just decided to look on it as a sort of pension. Well, one morning last March the man had an attack of some sort down there, and Mr. Lamb got his own car out and went home with him, himself, and worried about him, and went to see him no end all the time he was ill." "He would," Mrs. Palmer said approvingly. "He's a kind-hearted creature, that old man." Her husband laughed. "Alfred says he thinks his kind-heartedness is about cured. It seems that as soon as the man got well again, he deliberately walked off with the old gentleman's glue secret. Just calmly stole it. Alfred says he believes that if he had a stroke in the office now himself, his father wouldn't lift a finger to help him." Mrs. Palmer repeated the name to herself thoughtfully. "Adams. Virgil Adams? You said his name was Virgil Adams?" "Yes." She looked at her daughter. "Why, you know who that is, Mildred," she said casually. "It's that Alice Adams's father, isn't it? Wasn't his name Virgil Adams?" "I think it is," Mildred said. Mrs. Palmer turned toward her husband. "You've seen this Alice Adams here. Mr. Lamb's pet swindler must be her father." Mr. Palmer passed a smooth hand over his neat gray hair, which was not disturbed by this effort to stimulate recollection. "Oh, yes," he said. "Of course, certainly. Quite a good-looking girl. One of Mildred's friends. How queer!" Mildred looked up, as if in a little alarm, but did not speak. Her mother set matters straight. "Fathers are amusing," she said smilingly to Russell, who was looking at her, though how fixedly she did not notice, for she turned from him at once to enlighten her husband. "Every girl who meets Mildred and tries to push the acquaintance by coming here until the poor child has to hide isn't a friend of hers, my dear." Mildred's eyes were downcast again, and a faint color rose in her cheeks. "Oh, I shouldn't put it quite that way about Alice Adams," she said, in a low voice. "I saw something of her for a time. She's not unattractive, in a way." Mrs. Palmer settled the whole case of Alice carelessly. "A pushing sort of a girl," she said. "A very pushing little person." "I—" Mildred began, and after hesitating concluded, "I rather dropped her." "Fortunate you've done so," her father remarked, cheerfully. "Especially since various members of the Lamb connection are here frequently. They mightn't think you'd shown a great deal of tact in having her about the place." He laughed and turned to his cousin. "All this isn't very interesting to poor Arthur. How terrible people are with a newcomer in town. They talk as if he knew all about everybody." "But we don't know anything about these queer people ourselves," said Mrs. Palmer. "We know something about the girl, of course. She used to be a bit too conspicuous, in fact. However, as you say, we might find a subject more interesting for Arthur." She smiled whimsically upon the young man. "Tell the truth," she said. "Don't you fairly detest going into business with that tyrant yonder?" "What? Yes, I beg your pardon," he stammered. "You were right," Mrs. Palmer said to her husband. "You've bored him so, talking about thievish clerks, he can't even answer an honest question." But Russell was beginning to recover his outward composure. "Try me again," he said. "I'm afraid I was thinking of something else." This was the best he found to say. There was a part of him that wanted to protest and deny, but he had not heat enough in the chill that had come upon him. Here was the first mention of Alice, and with it the reason why it was the first. Mr. Palmer had difficulty in recalling her, and she had happened to be spoken of only because her father's betrayal of a benefactor's trust had been so particularly atrocious that, in the view of the benefactor's family, it contained enough of the element of humor to warrant a mild laugh at a club. There was the deadliness of the story, its lack of malice, even of resentment. Deadlier still were Mrs. Palmer's phrases, "a pushing sort of girl," "a very pushing little person," and "used to be a bit too conspicuous, in fact." But she spoke placidly and by chance, being as obviously without unkindly motive as Mr. Palmer was when he related the cause of Alfred Lamb's amusement. Her opinion of the obscure young lady momentarily her topic had been expressed, moreover, to her husband and at her own table. She sat there, large, kind, serene. A protest might astonish, but could not change her. And Russell, crumpling in his strained fingers the lace-edged little web of a napkin upon his knee, found heart enough to grow red, but not enough to challenge her. She noticed his color and attributed it to the embarrassment of a scrupulously gallant gentleman caught in a lapse of attention to a lady. "Don't be disturbed," she said benevolently. "People aren't expected to listen all the time to their relatives. A high color is very becoming to you, Arthur, but it really isn't necessary between cousins. You can always be informal enough with us to listen only when you care to." His complexion continued to be ruddier than usual, however, throughout the meal, and was still somewhat tinted when Mrs. Palmer rose. "The man's bringing you cigarettes here," she said, nodding to the two gentlemen. "We'll give you a chance to do the sordid kind of talking we know you really like. After a while, Mildred will show you what's in bloom in the hothouse, if you wish, Arthur." Mildred followed her, and when they were alone in another of the spacious rooms, went to a window and looked out, while her mother seated herself near the center of the room in a gilt armchair mellowed with old tapestry. Mrs. Palmer looked thoughtfully at her daughter's back, but did not speak until her coffee had been brought for them. "Thanks," Mildred said, not turning. "I don't care for any coffee, I believe." "No," Mrs. Palmer said gently. "I'm afraid our good-looking cousin won't think you're very talkative, Mildred. You spoke only about twice at lunch. I shouldn't care for him to get the idea you're piqued because he's come here so little lately, should you?" "No, I shouldn't," Mildred answered in a low voice, and with that she turned quickly and came to sit near her mother. "But it's what I am afraid of. Mama, did you notice how red he got?" "You mean when he was caught not listening to a question of mine? Yes, it's very becoming to him." "Mama, I don't think that was the reason. I don't think it was because he wasn't listening, I mean." "No?" "I think his color and his not listening came from the same reason," Mildred said, and although she had come to sit near her mother, she did not look at her. "I think it happened because you and Papa..." She stopped. "Yes?" Mrs. Palmer said, good-naturedly, to prompt her. "Your father and I did something embarrassing?" "Mama, it was because of those things that came out about Alice Adams." "How could that bother Arthur? Does he know her?" "Don't you remember," the daughter asked, "the day after my dance I mentioned how odd I thought it was in him? I was a little disappointed in him. I'd been seeing that he met everybody, of course, but she was the only girl he asked to meet, and he did it as soon as he noticed her. I hadn't meant to have him meet her. In fact, I was rather sorry I'd felt I had to ask her, because she... Oh, well, she's the sort that tries for the new man, if she has half a chance, and sometimes they seem quite fascinated. For a time, that is. I thought Arthur was above all that, or at the very least I gave him credit for being too sophisticated." "I see," Mrs. Palmer said, thoughtfully. "I remember now that you spoke of it. You said it seemed a little peculiar, but of course it really wasn't. A new man has nothing to go by except his own first impressions. You can't blame poor Arthur. She's quite a piquant-looking little person. You think he's seen something of her since then?" Mildred nodded slowly. "I never dreamed such a thing till yesterday, and even then I rather doubted it, till he got so red just now. I was surprised when he asked to meet her, but he just danced with her once and didn't mention her afterward. I forgot all about it. In fact, I virtually forgot all about her. I've seen quite a little of her." "Yes," said Mrs. Palmer. "She did keep coming here." "But I'd just about decided that it really wouldn't do," Mildred went on. "She isn't... well, I didn't admire her." "No," her mother assented, and evidently followed a direct connection of thought in a speech apparently irrelevant. "I understand the young Malone wants to marry Henrietta. I hope she won't. He seems rather a gross type of person." "Oh, he's just the one," Mildred said. "I don't know that he and Alice Adams were ever engaged. She never told me so. She may not have been engaged to any of them. She was just enough among the other girls to get talked about, and one of the reasons I felt a little inclined to be nice to her was that they seemed to be rather edging her out of the circle. It wasn't long before I saw they were right, though. I happened to mention I was going to give a dance, and she pretended to take it as a matter of course that I meant to invite her brother. At least, I thought she pretended. She might really have believed it. At any rate, I had to send him a card, but I didn't intend to be let in for that sort of thing again, of course. She's what you said, pushing, though I'm awfully sorry you said it.
Why shouldn't I have said it, my dear?
Of course, I didn't say shouldn't, Mildred explained gravely. I meant only that I'm sorry it happened.
Yes, but why?
Mama, Mildred turned to her, leaning forward and speaking in a lowered voice. Mama, at first, the change was so little it seemed as if Arthur hardly knew it himself. He'd been lovely to me, as always, and he was still lovely to me, but, oh, well, you've understood. After my dance, it was more as if it was just his nature and his training to be lovely to me, as he would be to everyone, a kind of politeness. He had never said he cared for me, but after that I could see he didn't. It was clear after that. I didn't know what had happened. I couldn't think of anything I'd done.
Mama, it was Alice Adams.
Mrs. Palmer set her little coffee cup upon the table beside her, calmly following her own motion with her eyes, and not seeming to realize with what serious entreaty her daughter's gaze was fixed upon her. Mildred repeated the last sentence of her revelation and introduced a stress of insistence.
"Mama, it was Alice Adams."
But Mrs. Palmer declined to be greatly impressed, so far as her appearance went at least, and, to emphasize her refusal, she smiled indulgently.
"What makes you think so?"
"Henrietta told me yesterday." At this, Mrs. Palmer permitted herself to laugh softly aloud. "Good heavens, is Henrietta a soothsayer? Or is she Arthur's particular confidant?"
"No, Ella Dowling told her."
Mrs. Palmer's laughter continued. "Now we have it," she exclaimed. "It's a game of gossip. Arthur tells Ella, Ella tells Henrietta, and Henrietta tells—"
"Don't laugh, please, Mama," Mildred begged.
"Of course Arthur didn't tell anybody. It's roundabout enough, but it's true. I know it. I hadn't quite believed it, but I knew it was true when he got so red. He looked—oh, for a second or so he looked stricken. He thought I didn't notice it, Mama. He's been to see her almost every evening lately. They take long walks together. That's why he hasn't been here." Of Mrs. Palmer's laughter there was left only her indulgent smile, which she had not allowed to vanish.
"Well, what of it?" she said.
"Mama!"
"Yes," said Mrs. Palmer. "What of it?"
"But don't you see—" Mildred's well-tutored voice, though modulated and repressed even in her present emotion, nevertheless had a tendency to quaver. "It's true. Frank Dowling was going to see her one evening, and he saw Arthur sitting on the stoop with her and didn't go in. And Ella used to go to school with a girl who lives across the street from her. She told Ella—"
"Oh, I understand," Mrs. Palmer interrupted.
"Suppose he does go there?"
"My dear, I said, what of it?"
"I don't see what you mean, Mama. I'm so afraid he might think we knew about it, and that you and Papa said those things about her and her father on that account, as if we abused them because he goes there instead of coming here."
"Nonsense."
Mrs. Palmer rose, went to a window, and, turning there, stood with her back to it, facing her daughter and looking at her cheerfully.
"Nonsense, my dear. It was perfectly clear that she was mentioned by accident, and so was her father. What an extraordinary man! If Arthur makes friends with people like that, he certainly knows better than to expect to hear favorable opinions of them. Besides, it's only a little passing thing with him."
"Mama, when he goes there almost every—"
"Yes," Mrs. Palmer said dryly.
"It seems to me I've heard somewhere that other young men have gone there almost every—"
"She doesn't last, apparently."
"Arthur is gallant, and he's impressionable, but he's fastidious, and fastidiousness is always the check on impressionableness. A girl belongs to her family, too, and this one does especially, it strikes me. Arthur is very sensible. He sees more than you would think."
Mildred looked at her hopefully.
"Then you don't believe he's likely to imagine we said those things of her in any meaning way?" At this, Mrs. Palmer laughed again.
"There's one thing you seem not to have noticed, Mildred."
"What's that?"
"It seems to have escaped your attention that he never said a word."
"Mightn't that mean—" Mildred began, but she stopped.
"No, it mightn't," her mother replied, comprehending easily. "On the contrary, it might mean that instead of his feeling it too deeply to speak, he was getting a little illumination."
Mildred rose and came to her.
"Why do you suppose he never told us he went there? Do you think he's
pleased with her and yet ashamed of it? Why do you suppose he's never spoken of it?"
"Ah, that," Mrs. Palmer said.
"That might possibly be her own doing. If it is, she's well paid by what your father and I said, because we wouldn't have said it if we'd known that Arthur—"
She checked herself quickly. Looking over her daughter's shoulder, she saw the two gentlemen coming from the corridor toward the wide doorway of the room, and she greeted them cheerfully.
"If you've finished with each other for a while," she added, "Arthur might find it a relief to put his thoughts on something prettier than a trust company, and more fragrant." Arthur came to Mildred. "Your mother said at lunch that perhaps you would..."
"I didn't say perhaps, Arthur," Mrs. Palmer interrupted, to correct him. "I said she would. If you care to see and smell those lovely things out yonder, she'll show them to you. Run along, children."
Half an hour later, glancing from a window, she saw them come from the hothouses and slowly cross the lawn. Arthur had a fine rose in his buttonhole, and he looked profoundly thoughtful. End of chapter 20.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Save big on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. Finish up projects with GE-branded silicone sealants. Tub and tile silicone is 100% waterproof and offers same-day water readiness, making it perfect to use in kitchens and bathrooms. Shop our selection of GE sealants in-store and on Menards.com and save big. Plus, check out the weekly flyer to view all of our other great deals happening this week.
Save big.